Mini episode 48 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by DOU Productions, delivering coverage of sports and pop culture through columns, live blogs, and original videos. Follow them on the web at generationchatter.blogspot.com.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
All right, welcome back here in the FDH Lounge. Rick Morris, Chris Galloway, breaking it down for you here today. Chris Galloway, one of our original dignitaries in the FDH Lounge. We're going to be getting into a little bit of our thoughts on the electorate and our thoughts on why some of the things have materialized. We've already, here in a previous mini-episode, broken down some of the X's and O's of the presidential campaign. But why are things coming out the way that they are? Why is this picture materializing the way that it is? And I guess I'll start with something here, because I think so much of it's going to come back to this point. A lot of it is as a result of trends, I guess, that have been building up for years. But a lot of this goes back to this economic sickness in this country that's really taken hold very firmly since the fall of Lehman Brothers in 2008, TARP, and everything that followed from that. You said when we were breaking down some of the X's and O's here about the Tea Party and about Occupy Wall Street, looking at a lot of the same things, finding different reasons and causes and villains behind it, but being motivated by a lot of the same forces. So let's start there as far as the frustration people are feeling and the way that they're lashing out and the way that they're looking for people to be accountable. Both on the left and on the right, we're seeing a need for boogeymen. And I don't even say boogeyman in a derisive sense, because I believe there are boogeymen that need to be held to account. But as far as what people are looking at and how that's fueling this kind of poisonous mood of the electorate.
Well, listen, when you get into a situation when you have economic upheaval, you have a situation where the world is changing, jobs are lost, there are tax implications, there are governments with sovereign debt burdens that they can't pay for. This isn't just 10 years. I mean, this is, 50, 60 years of this, really post-World War II, a lot of symptoms sort of coming together, and they're sort of converging right now. You can look at it from a lot of different ways. The changing economic global situation where, post-World War II, the United States was the only game in town, frankly, in terms of an economic engine within the world. And we benefited greatly from that. Near full employment. People had, jobs that involved manual labor, but they got paid top dollar to do them. People made good livings. It was sort of, an unusual time in human history, really, when you look back at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, over time, the rest of the world has caught up. Europe rebuilt, Japan rebuilt, China's emerging. And those people in those places have an interest in making products and creating jobs and making money as much as Americans do. And so it's created a much more difficult global economic climate that we're not necessarily just, even though we're still at the top, we're not the only game in town anymore. And so that's created a lot of economic pressures, especially when folks are losing jobs and they're losing opportunities that used to be there, that were there for their parents. It creates frustration. You throw in that we have an American society that has sort of fallen under the spell of, looking for government to solve its problems as individuals, be it through legislation or various forms of entitlements. Well, that all costs money. But at the same time, we have this belief that America is a unique place, and it is, and as it relates to freedom, democracy, democratic capitalism, and we don't like to pay taxes.
Right.
And so we've reached a point where we are demanding the services and the expenses through Congress, through budget processes, state budgets, local budgets, that we want all these services, we want all these, we want all these things that cost a lot of money, prescription drug coverage, and if you look at our U.S. budget, that's the number one thing that's just killing us right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want all these services and we want all these, if you will, quote-unquote freebies from government, and we want government to provide it, but we don't want to pay for it. And so government is now struggling to, you know, and for a long time, we could get away with it. We'll kick the can down the road. You know, governments, presidents, congresses, they provided these services and these benefits on the backs of our great-grandchildren by incurring debt and incurring debt. Well, now it's not sustainable anymore. It was never going to be eternally sustainable.
Right.
Europe has the exact same problem.
Right.
They've been paying, they've been doing things that they can't afford either, living beyond their means for far too long.
Right.
Well, we in this country have been doing the same thing. So now that's come together at the same time you have economic upheaval globally, jobs shifting, economic, you know, the paradigm is shifting. There's increased competition. Now suddenly the U.S. can't afford all the benefits. We can't afford to do all these things. And or you can. You just have to raise taxes a lot. And so there's all this angst. There's all this anxiety. You throw in the economic collapse from 2007 and 2008 because of the housing bubble, subprime market, the shenanigans of the too-big-to-fail banks. And, you know, and what you have is most folks are very anxious about the future. They're most anxious about, you know, where they're going to have their jobs. You've got most families in this country are, you know, two-earner income now just to stay, you know, above the Mendoza line, just to keep themselves from becoming homeless or losing their home. And, you know, you've got middle class that are now effectively living paycheck to paycheck. And so they're looking at that. But at the same time, when you have, you know, in a free market, there are always people that are going to benefit and they're going to prosper and they're going to make money. Well, it's easy to make $100 million when you have $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 1%, as the Occupy Wall Street folks like to call them, have continued to make money. And even while everybody else is suffering and struggling, you know, you see hedge fund managers, hey, that guy made $400 million last year. And you've got a guy who owns a hardware store on Main Street in Kansas, and he's looking at that, and, you know, and last year he eked out a small profit. And he's struggling to get his daughter through college at Kansas State. And he's looking at some guy living in Darien, Connecticut, who's making $400 million a year, basically just moving money around.
Right.
And he's saying, what is wrong with this? There's something seriously ill about our country. And then you throw into the fact that our tax code is so convoluted that a lot of these guys, you know, like i.e. Warren Buffett has said, he paid a lower tax rate than his secretary. You throw all this together and it's creating a very volatile period. And people, I think, are rightfully so saying there's something wrong, that you shouldn't have people that are, you know, like a Warren Buffett paying a lower percentage of taxes. Now, obviously, his actual dollars that he's paying are far exceed his secretary.
Right.
But as a percentage, he's paying less than his secretary. Why is a guy in, you know, running a hedge fund in, you know, who lives in, you know, Stamford, Connecticut, and he's paying almost no taxes?
Right.
And so there's this certain sense of, at least in America, where there's always a sense of, listen, we've always been okay with people making money and getting rich because everyone in America wants to be that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of our system. But what they don't like is this sort of inherent unfairness that got unearthed in the last few years because of this upheaval, where now people are realizing that look at the money they make, but look at how little they pay us a percentage of versus what I pay. And look at, they got into trouble. What's the first thing the government did? Well, we've got to bail them all out.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to bail out these Wall Street guys.
Mm-hmm.
So because, you know, they create the capital that creates jobs. Well, that's true. From an academic standpoint, you know, I agreed with TARP. I mean, I think TARP was a necessary, you know, if you will, evil.
Yeah.
At that moment in time, you know, the global
right.
economy was on the precipice of complete disaster. The entire banking industry would have collapsed, and then
right.
Lord knows what would have happened.
I hated it, but we couldn't go to Mad Max. We couldn't go to that point
couldn't. No. Now, the stimulus, hated that, never would
yeah.
support that in a second, because that was just blatant federal government giveaways, increasing our debt
yeah.
unnecessarily. And if you look at the TARP money, we've gotten all of it back and actually made some money off the deal, basically.
Right.
So it was an investment that we didn't want to make, but we had to make. But you look at the average guy on the street, and he says, so some guy who made $400 million, you're basically bailing him out.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's bailing me out when I lose my job at the Maytag plant. No one's coming along saying, hey, Joe Bag of Donuts, you know, we're going to look out for you. Instead, what I hear is, hey, by the way, you know, the bank's not going to foreclose on you. But meanwhile, that guy who made that $100 million, who paid less in percentage of taxes than me, he got bailed out and made almost whole or pretty close to whole. And actually, if you look at revenue in the last 2 years, I mean, Wall Street's made more money under Obama than they did under Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's looking at that, and he's saying, these guys, no matter what happens, they make more money, they get wealthier, and the federal government is always there to bail them out with more and more and more money, and they're always protected. No one's protecting me. No one cares about me. No one's looking out after me. And that strikes people as inherently unfair and un-American. And so I think, you know, that's why a lot of people were opposed to Trump saying, let them take the haircut. They made the risk. They took the chances. They made a lot of money for a decade on all these shenanigans that put everybody in hot water. Mm-hmm. And now they should take the haircut. They should lose their shirts. But at the end of the day, if they lose their shirts, the banks collapse.
They're going to take us down with them.
Yeah. Everybody gets taken down with them. And so there's a frustration in the system in the way it's developed. And the left looks at it and says, oh, it's just greedy Wall Street. And the right looks at it and says, we've got to have tax reform. But they're looking at the same systemic ills, just from different sides of the coin, I believe.
I think so, too. And, you know, you made some very good points there. I mean, I think that'll be the foundation, a couple of the different things you said for the rest of our conversation here. Again, it's been a passion of mine that since we first started talking politics in the early days of the FDH Lounge, really during the last presidential election cycle, to get beyond the echo chamber, bumper sticker, mouth breather stuff. And you made some very good points that are outside of that particular paradigm, and I appreciate that. Before we get back to any of the points of causation on this, I want to go to something you said about the frustration right now. I see a real danger point for the Republicans, for Newt Gingrich out there that are doing all the hippie punching on Occupy Wall Street. Yeah, okay, there's points to be made about the excesses of it, the messes, I guess, that are getting left behind, whatever. But if Newt Gingrich is coming out there at rallies, you know, with George Thorogood blaring, get a haircut and get a real job, that's not what you want in this economy. That's not what you want in this day and age. If the Republicans throw out the baby with the bathwater because everybody's PO'd, whether or not they're out there camping on Wall Street to express their anger about it.
Well, that's just short-sightedness, and it's also bad management on their part.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that shows a bit of a tin ear as to what the public is going through.
The real pain.
And of course, you know, how can you expect a guy with a $300,000 Tiffany's bill to understand what the average American is going through?
Good point.
Frankly,
right.
That's what that reeks of.
Yeah.
And, I don't think that helps him. And there is a real danger. Now, I think if the Republicans were smart, looking at it simply from a strategic standpoint, You at one point referenced 1968.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Republicans ought to let Occupy Wall Street play out.
Mm-hmm.
They ought to just keep their mouths shut. You know, Fox News really ought to just report on it straight and just shut up.
Right.
And the reason is because that group, unlike the Tea Party, which is mostly made up of average blue collar hardworking Americans who are, you know, concerned about, you know, where their government is taking their country. You know, the Occupy Wall Street folks, there are some of those folks in there,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of them are leftists, old 60s university professors.
Yep.
You've got the Acorn folks. You've got a bunch of these sort of community activists and, frankly, just a lot of Fruit Loops.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you let them just to their own devices and let them just go, you know, by fall of 2012, those protests and those, they could be making a really bad scene in terms of their message, you know, dancing around with, you know, and the average guy living, you know, in some suburban neighborhood and some soccer mom can't identify with a bunch of kids who just, you know, came off of campus and are you know, smoking pot or, you know, dancing around in the street, you know, in goofy signs. They can't identify with it. They won't identify with it. So I think in some sense, strategically, it'd be smarter for Republicans to sit back and let them do their thing, because at some point they're going to damage themselves, not necessarily so much with the message, but, if you will, the messenger will become something that most Americans can't even identify with. So I think Republicans are better off just to let it play out, because that could actually work to their advantage come next fall.
It could, but it would take a level of discipline that the Republicans have yet to really show, not just in the last year or two, but in the last several years. I mean, I go back to the last presidential election cycle, writing columns for the blog saying you can't throw the kitchen sink at Barack Obama. You have to be focused on, he's a celebrity. He's, and they think they're so clever. They're not clever. That didn't move the needle at all.
No.
You have to just set aside the short-term thing. I'm going to win today's news cycle. You have to take a longer view of these kind of things here. And the whole Occupy Wall Street bashing thing is about today's news cycle, winning the news cycle, when, like you said, there's a real potential for these folks to discredit themselves by going too far, having bad messages to come out of this thing as far as what they think should be done. But you have to have the patience, as you said, to let it play out.
Well, I think you've just touched on something, and that is that too much of the Republican Party policies and the way we engage in the campaign is being dictated by our own news media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's, you know, Fox News or some other news outlet, we are now game planning everything towards the 24, this sort of, you know, the sort of cable TV mindset. That's what Republicans are doing now. It's campaigning from Rush Limbaugh's show to the Fox News show, and that's where we're putting all of our focus on, you know, sort of, we're doing the same thing now. We've got ourselves in that mediated mindset of winning the day, winning today's message. Well, there's a degree of importance to that. You don't ever want to get off message, but too much of the Republican Party now is that's what it's all about. It's all about, you know, who's, you know, let's make sure we get on Fox News and get the better ratings. Let's, you know, let's out poll this, you know, particular media outlet. And there's, that's important, but we're losing sight of the bigger strategic picture. And sometimes, you know, it does take patience, and it's not, a lot of that's not being displayed right now, i.e. when you look at Newt saying get a haircut and get a job. Well, that's great. That plays to a certain part of the a part of his crowd that he's out there with right now. But, you know, there's plenty of people out there that don't have a job and are saying, well, sure, Newt, where's my job? I mean, I'd like to work, but I don't know where it is. And so he got a great soundbite, and he did it intentionally, because what did it do? It got him on Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, that's going to come back to bite him in the rear when they start talking about unemployment and they start talking about his personal life and his finances.
Yeah, and it's offensive to all of us who have friends who are in real pain, and I unfortunately have at least a handful who are. So, yeah, it's offensive to people when he does stuff like that. But I think it's a larger issue, too, when you're looking at this, when you're looking at the need to pander in that kind of a way. I've been saying for years, I describe myself, I'm an ideologue, not a partisan. I'm not a Republican Party partisan. I have ideas. I have things I want implemented. All I care about are getting ideas implemented and getting things done and getting the country turned around. I'm one of those people where that's all I care about. So I'm always looking down the road beyond what's happening now to what's going to get us there. I had somebody say something to me during the last presidential election cycle that really made an impact on me as far as how I viewed things here. Our senior editor, Jason Jones, during that campaign cycle, he and his wife moved out to Colorado. They were living at the time in Colorado Springs, which is a real hotbed for some of this right-wing radio. And Jason is a guy who is pretty much middle of the road. I guess maybe he leans right on some stuff, but kind of makes up his opinion from scratch every presidential campaign. Looks at the candidates, whatever, looks at it in a very starting from scratch kind of way.
I.e. he's most Americans.
He is. He is. And you know what he said to me? He said that in listening to that right-wing talk station out there and the whole preaching to the choir stuff, and he was offended and he was turned off. Because it was this whole thing of, you know, I know there's some idiots out there that don't think that Obama is a socialist from Kenya. and he's listening to this, and he's getting turned off. And I never looked at it that way before in my life. I always thought to myself, okay, the people who listen to these things, whatever, it's harmless. Some of it might be stupid, but at least it's being confined amongst the community that listens to this. No. And that's when I really first started to pay attention to this stuff. The messages that are part of this right-wing echo chamber that get broadcast to the outside, the groupthink, the real mouth-breathing bumper sticker kind of stuff here, that does very real damage. I'm convinced that if it weren't for talk radio and some other things, Obama would be 5 points lower in the polls, a minimum of 5 points lower. Obama is being propped up by his enemies, I believe.
Well, I think there's probably some truth to that, although I don't know how many people that don't at least agree, say, with the positions of particular radio hosts actually listen to them.
I hope not too many.
I don't think that that's the case. I don't think that there are really that many, say, left-leaning Democrats that listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. They don't do it. And the same thing with Republicans that don't listen to, some of the leftists that are on the radio. Of course, you can't really get them on terrestrial radio.
That's true.
but they're out there, on satellite radio and on the internet and whatnot. I think that both the left and the right have fallen into their own echo chambers, and there's this sort of pride of, I never even talked to a Democrat, Well, okay, but what's that get us? I mean, when I hear congressmen talk like that, well, I don't even talk to the other side,
right?
Well, what do you then, no one's saying you have to agree with them or implement all of their policies or whatnot, but the idea that ideas are the sole possession of only one particular party is, I think, a silly one and extremely immature. And I think, somehow this polarization has manifested itself in our media today. And, I think that's where, 65-70% of the country is like Jason. They're still in the middle. And they move, and that's why elections have become so volatile, I believe. Why we've gone from, we went from, the country embracing Barack Obama to 2 years later completely scorning Barack Obama, with the election results that occurred. And the big middle doesn't, is looking for someone to get things done, as you just mentioned right there, get things done. They don't really know what it is, but they want elected officials to get things accomplished. They want to see some results. They want to see, you look at this sort of the budget debate in Congress about, they're like, the Democrats offered $10 in spending cuts for every $1 in revenue enhancement, or, i.e. taxes. And the Republicans all said what? Absolutely no way we could ever go along with that. Well,
right.
I don't think that the average American looks at that and says, I don't find that unreasonable. I don't find that idea unreasonable.
Because that's the biggest enemy of all.
Absolutely. So I think that in some ways, we've the Republicans with the tax issue, for example, have gotten themselves into a position where they've painted themselves into this corner that now they can't get out of under any circumstances. And I think there are plenty of Republicans in Congress that would love to be able to find a way out of it, including John Boehner. But because I think at the end of the day, the public is looking for elected officials that get things done, positive accomplishments, that they can see positive results, whether it's a tangible, we're lowering the debt, we are, unemployment is coming down, job growth is up, the tax structure has been cleaned up, the loopholes are removed, we've simplified it, we've taken out some of these, exemptions that shouldn't be there. I mean, that's what people are looking for. They're looking for results. They're not looking for demagoguery, and right now that's all they're getting. And so I think that's part of the wild swings you see in poll numbers, you see in, from election to election. The big middle of America is searching for elected officials that are going to get things done. And so... that's why it's sort of become unstable politically.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because again, I was somebody who, at least in the very beginning and probably until very recently, really described myself as being a Tea Party sympathizer, although I'm now sort of getting to where I agree with that in spirit as opposed to the way the people are interpreting it. I'd like to ask you something. As somebody who has been elected to public office and run for public office, I'm not going to invite you to do any constituent bashing here for obvious reasons, but I'm wondering in this climate, this air of unreality as far as our expectations of public officials, are you seeing an increasing amount out there of where's the chicken in every pot paid for by somebody else? I mean, is that mentality really getting out of control where that if you've held public office and you've gotten things done, you're somehow tainted versus Herman Cain, who's on a white horse, who is coming in from the outside? Are you getting the sense that people feel that?
I think that that is the case within the Republican Party right now.
Okay.
And I think that's where it exists right now.
Okay.
That unfortunately, if you've gotten some positive public policy done, someone is always going to find something wrong with it somewhere, mm-hmm. and they're going to beat you over the head with it. You know, it's easier to be a Herman Cain and just come in and say, 999. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great, but, you know, also, Herman Cain, do you realize a 9% national sales tax would be extremely regressive and hurt the middle class and the poor in a huge way? You know, so it's a great slogan, but that you don't have to back it up with anything. And,
right.
and I think within the Republican Party, we've unfortunately sort of become beholden to these kinds of, you know, these kinds of ideas right now. And, you know, you see it thrown around. I give the example of John Huntsman. You know, you see this label thrown around of, well, he's a rhino. Well, okay, that's a great label.
He's an Obama plant.
That's a label that keeps getting thrown around. And, you know, it has very little meaning anymore because, as far as I know, John Huntsman's always been a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a conservative governor. He was... you know, he cut taxes in Utah. They had the highest job growth in Utah when he was governor. He reduced regulations. He was a Mormon who loosened the alcohol regulations in the state of Utah. You know, he had a lot of positive things. I mean, Forbes magazine called him the best governor back during the time he was governor. They rated him the best governor. You know, conservative think tanks praised his policies. And so now what do we see? We see a guy who's successful, who's been successful in business, created a lot of jobs, created a lot of wealth for people, and was a successful governor, reformed government, reduced taxes, flattened taxes in Utah, created an environment that where a lot of jobs could be created. And he was asked by Obama to become ambassador to China because of his knowledge of the country, his business background, and in fact that he was fluent in Chinese.
Tactical thing by Obama, too. Thought
sure.
it would take him out of the mix.
Of course it was a tactical thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he asked him to be ambassador, and John Huntsman says, yes, I'd be happy to serve my country in such an important role. And anyone who thinks that ambassador to China is not an important role is got to go hit the textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
But and so he serves, what, 3 years as ambassador. He comes back and he says, okay, I want to run for president because I think we need some changes. And so the Republican Party, what do? So many go, well, he worked for Obama for a minute, so now he's a rhino. He's not really a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
What? Look at all the things that this guy has accomplished. You know, and so instead, rhetoric took over rather than reality. And unfortunately right now, and it's a criticism that pains me, but my Republican Party has become too beholden to that kind of rhetoric rather than reality. There are too many people within the Republican Party and in talk radio and whatnot that are substituting their imagination for reality.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, too. It's red team, blue team. Whose team are you on? Well, you're saying something that's not off my script, so you're on the other side. It's the
Well, it's not even red team, blue team now. It's red team and darker red.
That's
and
true.
So dark red, it's almost black. You
right.
know? And it's, you know, I go back to what Reagan said. He says, listen, if you're with, you know, we're referring to members of Congress. He said, any guy that's with me, you know, 85, 90% of the time is my friend. He's
mm-hmm.
not my enemy.
Right.
But right now in the Republican Party, not everyone, but there's a certain mindset in the blogosphere and the talk radio and all that, that where if you are with, you know, say someone, you know, if you're with, you know, Rush Limbaugh said, you know, if you're with Rush Limbaugh on 90% of issues, you're his enemy because you're not
yeah.
with him 100%. You're
yeah.
not pure enough. Well, I don't know. I have never met a candidate that I have agreed with every single issue
mm-hmm.
that they've been, where they've been on a particular issue. I've never met one.
Right.
And I would suggest as an elected official myself that I can't imagine that I could find another citizen in my community that would say, I agree with Chris on every single issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hope is that by and large, as an elected official, you do what you believe is best for your community. You do what is best for the short term and the long term, looking at that balance. You stay true to your beliefs and your ideals while you implement those public policies. And you have to be open-minded to saying, well, okay, we tried something and that didn't work. So even if it seems like that fits a certain dogma that we might hold, if it's not working, then you have to be willing to rethink it, a certain, you know, flexibility for the benefit of the public. And, you know, I think that's, you know, that's how I've tried to be an elected official.
Mm-hmm.
I get the sense that that's what most of the public is looking for in an elected official, is someone who's going to say, let's try to get things done. Let's find solutions to problems. But, you know, let's have some values. Let's have some, you know, we all have things that we believe, you mm-hmm. know. And so let's hold to those values, and let's find ways within that construct to get some positive things done. And I think that's what the public's looking for. They're not looking for dogma. And I think, unfortunately, they're going to get dogma in 2012, a lot of it, and probably in 2014. And at some point, you know, when we talk about independent candidates, that's where they'll have an opportunity. And you know, again, it's a volatile time in American politics.
Well, and not only that, guardians of purity are the ones you should be listening to the least, it seems like. I made a joke before about John Sununu is now telling us who is and is not a conservative. Rush Limbaugh said the other day, Ron Paul, of all people, is not authentic Tea Party. Rush Limbaugh, with his snout on the colon of the Bush family for the last 25 years, is now defining who is and is not a Tea Party individual. So, again, these types of things here, part of what it is, too, if you, whichever political party you, you identify with, in the deepest, darkest recesses of your soul, you can admit certain things, whether you like them or not, if you're an intellectually honest person. For example, you touched on this at the very beginning. I want to circle around to this. The whole thing about Republicans and the free lunch. I go back to the 80s. Ronald Reagan made a deal with the devil in Congress, and I think it was justifiable what he did as far as essentially passing the Democrats' domestic agenda in return for the military spending to help take down the Soviet Union. To me, the results speak for themselves. It was not a great thing to have to do, but in a circumstance, I don't disagree with it. The problem is the trajectory was in place. Along comes George H.W. Bush, a very confrontation-averse president, following him from there. What you had to do at that moment in time was get us off of that trajectory. Because when you're talking about things being unsustainable, Chris, the 80s, that's really where it picked up. That's where deficits really started to mushroom.
I agree.
National debt really became huge. You had to, once the Cold War was done, okay, all right, we're going to start from scratch here, call it baseline budgeting, whatever you want to call it there. But since the 80s, we've been on this path. In the last decade, a self-professed conservative president racking up a huge war that was unpaid for in Iraq, a boondoggle to old people here, Medicare Part D, unpaid for prescription giveaway to old folks that's just exploding the debt and the deficit also. So things were bad before Obama got there, but Republicans have a need to pin everything on him when the truth would be bad enough. Taking us from approximately $10 trillion to approximately $15 trillion is bad enough. You don't have to lie about it. You don't have to make it look like you had no culpability in what came before. The truth is bad enough, and Republicans don't seem to trust the truth.
Well, I agree with that, and I think that's part of the frustration. That's where the Tea Parties come out, because I think that's the part, by and large, of folks that have been out in the wings of the Republican Party who have said, listen, you know, it's Republicans who have gotten off the reservation. You know, a lot of Tea Party, you know, they've become more a guardian of the Republican, you know, sort of the vanguard of the Republican Party, and saying, we're going to force these guys to try to stick to these ideals. And that is, you know, listen, we've got to have limited government. We've got to roll back regulation. We've got to reduce tax rates. We've got to, although historically tax rates are at an extremely low level that they've been in 50 years.
They are, so, but Republicans aren't supposed to say that.
Right. Well, I think that comes back to being intellectually honest. The tax rates are at an incredibly low rate that we've not seen in for a long, long time. And then our candidate's solution to these things is to come out and say, well, we need to lower tax rates. okay, maybe there are some things that are justified in lowering. There are some things that may be justified in raising. There may be some, you know, and by that, what of course, we refer to as the loopholes. You know, you close loopholes. In some sense, you are raising taxes.
Right.
But you're also eliminating this sort of inherent unfairness that people identify in both the Occupy Wall Street and in the Tea Party movement. That they see in the tax code, you know. I think that's what people are. That's what people are looking for. And right now, Republicans, unfortunately, and it pains me because it's my party, is not. We're not being terribly intellectually honest about our part in this mess. You know. That said, when you've got a situation in Congress where you can, you know, where you can get $10 of, you know, federal cuts. For, you know, every $1 of revenue enhancement, because it's whether it's through loopholes or whatnot, or raising taxes on the 1%, I think Republicans are, one, tactically giving Obama an issue to kill us with over and over again, where the Republicans only care about the rich. They're protecting the rich. Okay, why do we keep giving them that issue, A? And B, when you look at the entirety of the mess, the debt, and this is what I think the average American says, looks at it and says, yeah, I don't think we can fix this problem just by cutting. I think the average person looks at it and says, there's going to have to be some raising of taxes in certain places. Some people are going to have to pay more. Some people will pay less. Some people will pay more. There's going to have to be a way. We're not getting rid of $15 trillion in debt
right.
simply by cutting taxes.
Right.
Anybody that believes that is, you know, I mean, I'm sorry. It's just, it's, you know, maybe at $2 trillion in debt, you could probably find a way to do that through economic growth. At $15 trillion, I'm sorry, that train is out of the station. And we're going to have to make some hard choices. And that's going to include rolling back defense spending.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have, and the easiest way to do that is to get out of Afghanistan and Iraq as soon as possible and stop spending money there. Hand over fist.
And Europe, what's up with all the bases? Those were Cold War bases. Right. You know, well, Pat Buchanan's pointed this out. We have a lot of remnants of the Cold War that are very expensive, Chris.
We have to start rethinking that entire strategy. And then, you know, as it relates to our budget. And then, you know, we're going to have to be willing to accept the fact that there's going to be a curb on entitlements and benefits from the federal government. Mm-hmm. Those things have to be cut. We can't afford it. We can't pay for it. It's not really a hard concept. And so, you know, there are certain budgetary things that can be done that can help that situation. But at the end of the day, $15 trillion in debt, and you've got commitments, you know, for the next, you know, 30 to 40 years that we can't pay for, we're going to have to make changes. And I think the average American sees all that, and they're frustrated. The fact that no one seems to be willing. They watch the debt ceiling debate. They watch this super committee thing. And every single time Congress fails to come up with anything. And I think they would all get a huge boost had they come to something. Had they come out and said, we're cutting $10, you know, $10 for every dollar we're raising. I think their approval ratings would have shot through the roof. I mean, people would have said, finally, a path. These guys are coming up with some constructive ways to get our problems and to solve our problems. And that's where the frustration comes from those movements, from the average American, is that they're not seeing any solutions. They're seeing no change. And the Republican Party is stuck in a sort of a dogma cycle, labeling, and you've got guys that are out there, you know, claiming, you know, when you've got a guy like Newt Gingrich, who's a candidate, or, you know, a Rush Limbaugh, who's, you know, a one percenter, laying attacks on different people, you know, I think that you have a point about who should Republicans be listening to. They really should be evaluating who they're listening to.
Well, and making a deal like that, that's, let me just say this. You go all the way back, FDR himself pointed out, Republicans have to realize that in a certain way the battle's been lost because of where the American people are. FDR himself back in the day more or less said, hey, look, we're shooting some real opiates into the bloodstream here. People have gotten hooked on government. Between the New Deal and the Great Society, that battle's been lost because it's not popular to admit among Republicans, but people love these programs. I've seen polls where the Tea Party, like two-thirds of the Tea Party, like, hands off my Social Security and Medicare. The battle was lost if the Tea Party members are saying things
right.
like
well,
that.
Well, that's exactly right. It's the usual hypocrisy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and I'll be honest with you, I see it even in the local community in my role as a township trustee. You know, unfortunately, you I mean, I'll get, you know, I'll get folks that will come and say, like, wow, the township should be doing this, this, and this. And I'll be like, why is that our job to do those things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mr. So-and-so, I know you're a Republican, and I know what you think on other issues, and you think that my job or the township's job and taxpayers' job should be to solve your particular problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that mentality is permeating throughout American, the mindset, unfortunately. I don't know how you unroot that. But I will say this, on the one hand, the Tea Party should embrace the one victory that they have won, and the Republicans have won a certain victory, and that is that when you've got Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi sitting up in a press conference saying, we have got to cut federal spending, this has got to be, you know, we've got to find ways to cut federal spending, we've won an argument there.
Right.
And it's almost like we've won this huge victory, but we're not willing to accept the victory because it's only a 40-point victory. Because it's not a 42-point victory,
mm-hmm.
we're rejecting it. Like, no, we're not leaving the court yet because
right.
we haven't gotten everything we want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, the problem is that the Democrats control the White House and the Senate.
Right.
You know, and that's when I watch what goes on in Congress, and I go, the Democrats control the White House and the Senate, and that's where my frustrations with the Tea Party come in, where We control one body within the legislative, and yet we think we can dictate everything that'll happen.
Right.
So when you get a deal that says it's 10-1, and we all say no, that's
right.
not acceptable, we're off the tracks.
Right.
I mean, that's government that's not working, and no one wants tax increases. I mean, I don't want them, but there are times when you have to make hard decisions as an elected official and say, we've got to get out of this mess.
Right.
And there's no leadership standing up and saying, or there are some members of Congress that are saying it, but very little. And there's no one in the Tea Party, and there's no one in the, you know, not enough in the Republican Party saying, we've got to get this thing under control. And if it means raising some tax rates on the upper 1% and closing some loopholes and cutting $10 for every $1 that we do of that of federal spending, you know, let's go ahead and do this. That's a good start. We're winning the argument. Let's start to get this thing under control. No one's willing to do that. Everybody's holding out. And the Democrats are doing the same thing. You know, mm-hmm. we're here beating up the Republicans because it's sort
sure.
of like friendly fire.
They're demagoguing
it. They're doing the exact same thing.
Yes.
You can't touch this entitlement or that entitlement
right.
or this entitlement. And we have to have an expansion of the federal role in this, 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 and this.
Right.
And, you know, and Obama has screwed up the regulatory environment, which is really the reason why we're not seeing job growth in this
right.
country. Because I have talked to business owners, small and large, and what they'll say, what they'll tell you, as they've told me, is, listen, if I understood what the tax structure was going to be and what the regulatory environment was going to be as it relates to the EPA and their demands and the things that they're going to do and other governmental agencies, I can then plan for it, budget for it, and move forward with my corporate plans. I can hire people. But when I don't know how the federal government may mess with my business
right.
in a regulatory sense, and I don't know if I do this, this, and this in my budget, and then you turn around and do a 180 on a tax structure that totally kills me, I can't move forward. So it's that unknowing that has created a jobs paralysis in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like Obama's biggest crime, is
right.
that he has created so much uncertainty with his sort of, you know, I'm over here on this issue in the middle. Then the next thing you know, I'm a leftist on this issue, and I claim we're gonna roll back regulations, but at the same time, the EPA is expanding regulations. That's why companies are sitting on their cash, because there's an uncertainty. They don't know what the future holds. They don't know what the federal government's going to do to them, specifically this administration. And so they're unwilling to invest in a new building, expand a plant, hire some new people. And so that's killing us. And so, you know, we've got to get off the demagoguery, and we've got to get on to solutions.
Absolutely. And as we start to bring this full circle here, it really is a thing where, and again, where we're coming from on this, I mean, since I have first really started politics back, following politics in my youth back in the 80s or so, I mean, my whole life since I've been following this, I've really loathed the status quo. As somebody who's looking for results, as somebody who's looking for a turnaround, we got to get the trends of the last several decades moving in the other direction. Now, again, look, if we were fortunate enough in this country that I somehow magically became dictator, I mean, look, you should see the chainsaw I would use. I would make Ron Paul look like Hubert Humphrey. But that's not possible. You will keep going further down this path. Things aren't going to be turned around until you acknowledge that, hey, look, people like their government. As much as I would like to see a real hacksaw get put to a lot of this kind of stuff, Chris, that's the thing here, and you have to face this as a public official. There's a certain baseline of things well beyond what you and I would be comfortable with that people want, and the non-negotiable thing to them is to cut it. So that's how we end up in a free lunch situation. We're not paying for it because nobody wants to admit it. Nobody wants their taxes raised. But it's non-negotiable to these people for this stuff to be cut, regardless of what you and I think.
Well, I think you've hit right on the head. People do love their government. Mm-hmm. They want government to do things for them and to provide services and benefits. And they don't want to pay for them. Mm-hmm. And I see that at the local. I mean, I have people ask me for things all the time, you know. Well, why don't we have a big community pool? Or why don't we, you know, and I'll say, because that's not the role of government. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not doing that, you know, we're not doing that in Concord. Well, they've got that in Mentor, you know. Well, that's fine. And they're paying for it. We have lower tax rates. We don't have an income tax in Concord Township. And so we, you know, there's an old adage in who used to say, George Voinovich used to say it when he was governor, we need to do more with less.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's a great slogan, except I think the real slogan needs to be, we need to do less with less. And until people start to embrace that idea, mm-hmm. that the government should be doing less with less, we're going to continue on this trajectory. You're absolutely right. And I will say this, I mean, you know, this word compromise has become sort of, you know, if you will, verbal boogeyman, that neither side can feel like they can ever, you know, be guilty of a compromise. But that is politics. You have to find some common ground. You have to make some compromises to get some of the things you want. You've got to give up some stuff. And I think that when we're looking in this current situation that the at least the federal government is in, and most states are even in, you know, you're going to have to make some hard choices, and you may have to make some compromises along the way, and you have to find a way to make the most palatable ones.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there are some things that you can't compromise on, and I think there are some things that you have to be willing to have some flexibility in. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that out of Washington right now.
Right.
And I think that's where the frustration for the average person comes into play, is that it's a dire situation. People are losing their jobs. They're underemployed. They're having a hard time. They're living paycheck to paycheck, and then they watch Washington, and they can't seem to get anything done. And that's at the end. Again, I keep coming back to that point. My experience as an elected official is people appreciate elected officials who get stuff accomplished. You know, whether it's at the local level, state level, or the federal level, that you can actually say, this is what we've got done in a concrete sense. These are the positive things that we've been able to get accomplished in moving the ball forward from a short-term and a long-term perspective. That's where people are looking for leadership, and they're not seeing it right now. And therefore, we have the volatility that we have within the Republican primary situation. We have the, you know, the potential, you know, we see that in the Tea Party movement and the Occupy Wall Street movement. We see that in the potential for independent candidates for president. We see that in a 9% approval rating for Congress. We see that in, you know, so many things within our public life now is because there's not enough leadership.
Well, I understand that. And again, the last point that I want to make on this is, I think, and again, and this is something I've been beating the drum on for years, we need to start thinking more, emoting less. All right? I don't emote on politics. The reason I'm not a leftist is because I don't believe that plutocrats have a money tree in their backyard that they can just go pluck hundies off of here.
Well, Europe's learning that.
Well, they're learning that, exactly. Yeah, their whole thing of, you uptight Americans, you should work 30 hours a week and retire at 50, eh? Yeah, I guess we're not the stupid ones, because they're the ones that are finding out they can't pay for stuff. But if you're on the right, you're supposed to be on the right because you're thinking about stuff. And there was stuff that was pointed out in the last decade. Some of the folks I used to see that were real emotionally invested in the last administration. That's Bush derangement syndrome. These folks have Bush derangement syndrome. Okay, there probably were a lot of leftists out there that had that, but I see, the same people I see crying about that the most are the ones that want to call you not a conservative if you're not throwing epithets at this president. When this president is attacked on policy and effects of policy, it is effective. When he is attacked personally or emotionally or anything else like that, it just plays into his own hands, and I think that's the thing that people need to be looking at. Maybe that's our bottom line here. People got to keep their eye on the ball, Chris.
Well, I agree. And look, we saw the same thing with Bill Clinton for 8 years. When we attacked him personally and emotionally, it didn't work. When you could go after his specific policies, i.e. the 1994 election, it worked. And I don't think that's something that's unique just to Obama. And that should give a lot of Republicans something to think about as they move into 2012. Whether they're candidates for anything, any particular office, be thinking about that. The emotional and the personal doesn't work. This is going to be an environment that's all going to be about, solutions, be it criticizing, bad things that your opponent has done, or, i.e. the president, but you've also got to bring something to the table and say, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I'm about, and this is where I believe we ought to be going as a community, a state, or as a nation. And, I think that's what's going to win elections in 2012, is people that are candidates that are focused on solutions and getting things done.
Absolutely. That's the bottom line. Keep your eyes on the ball, people. Got to stay focused on what's happening here. That is what, of course, we always try to do in the FDH Lounge. We'll be doing it through the 2012 election cycle as we did 2008 when we first started up the lounge in that cycle. And you were a part of things then, Chris, and look forward to doing more stuff as we move through 2012.
It's a pleasure as always, Rick. Merry Christmas.
Thanks, pal. Merry Christmas.